Well, the book is called Radical Evolution. He's a best-selling author, Joel Gouraud, a reporter, editor for the Washington Post, showing us that we are at an inflection point in history. Well, what does it all mean? Advances in genetics, robotics, information, nanotechnologies. We are altering our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, our progeny, and perhaps our very souls. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Joel Gouraud is a reporter and editor at the Washington Post, a member of the Global Business Network, and a principal of the Gouraud Group, a network of his best sources committed to understanding who we are, how we got this way, and where we're headed. He has served as a senior fellow at the University of California at Berkeley and the George Mason University. In addition, Joel is the author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. His book takes an unprecedented, sometimes alarming, always spellbinding look at the hinge in history at which we have arrived. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Joel, how are you?
I'm great, George. How are you?
Good to be with us. So you are committed to the understanding of who we are. And let me tell you, if you can ever get that answered, you may win yourself a Nobel Prize in science.
Wouldn't that be great?
I tell you, I have been batting my head against the wall since I was a young boy trying to answer that question of who we are. Are we getting any closer to finding out?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the critical points about radical evolution is that, you know, we've been trying to figure out who we are as humans for a long time. We've tried Christian enlightenment and Buddhist enlightenment and Cartesian logic. We've tried a bunch of things, but now we're beginning to take control of our own fate in a way that we've never seen before. So we may have a shot at this yet.
What's doing it to us, Joel? Is it the technology or is it something else?
Well, George, we're at a turning point in history. For the first time in hundreds of thousands of years, our technologies are not so much aimed outward at modifying our environment, like fire and clothes and agriculture and cities. Now, for the first time, our technologies are increasingly aimed inward at modifying our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, our kids, and what it means to be human. And as I say, this is the biggest change in tens of thousands of years at what it means about what it makes us tick. What's happening is that we're taking control of our own evolution, as amazing as that sounds. And what radical evolution is trying to do is be a roadmap to that change. This is not some science fiction. You know, this is not some far distant future. I'm talking about this kind of change happening on our watch in the next 3, 5, 10, 15 years.
You know, I have always thought that technology will save us all from the imminent disaster we all face. It will prolong our lives. It already is. But then there's another part of me, Joel, that sees some groups and agencies that just don't want us to live forever. They don't want us to survive. They don't want to cure disease. They only want to cure some of the symptoms. I'm at odds with that. Are you also fighting that battle within yourself?
Well, in Radical Evolution, I lay out three scenarios for how this might work out. Heaven, hell, and prevail. I don't have a single prediction in the book, I don't think. What I'm doing is reporting what's in the lab and then trying to figure out, well, you know, what does this mean to us? I mean, so much for the techie stuff. You know, what does this mean to humans and relationships and having loves and lives? And what's driving all this is a curve of technological change like nothing we've ever seen before. Back in 1959, when the computer chip was first introduced, It was an amazing thing. And 6 years later, there was this guy named Gordon Moore, who turned out to be one of the three founders of Intel, you know, Intel inside the computer
people. Yep, absolutely.
And Gordon back then, even then, noticed that the number of transistors that you could get onto a piece of silicon for a dollar was regularly doubling every few months. And he made this bold prediction that this was going to occur again and again. And sure enough, over the last 46 years, we've seen 30 doublings in this computer power. Now, that's unprecedented in human history, because a doubling is a pretty amazing thing. It means that every new step is as tall as all of the previous steps put together. And we've had a new one of those steps every 18 months now since 1959. That's an increase of over 400 million times in the lifetimes of a lot of people who are listening to this show.
I got to tell you, Joel, if we could find a stock that would give us that kind of rate of return, we'd all have a lot of money for the rest of our lives, wouldn't
we? Well, Mr. Moore is doing just fine, thank you.
He's doing
just fine. Yeah, but that's absolutely right, and that goes to some issues about what radical evolution is all about, because not only are we talking about what it means to be human, but we're talking about all of our jobs and all of our investments, and how it'll affect how we're going to grow old.
Is there going to be a point though where Moore's law, this doubling of speed, computer speed and knowledge, that it's not going to happen? I mean, are they going to miss it eventually?
Well, that's a great question. Everybody in the computer business figures that if you look at a two-dimensional piece of silicon like what we've got now, you can't keep this doubling up much beyond the year 2015, because by that point the wires, in effect, get down to the size of molecules. But now the question is, do you think Intel is just going to give up at that point? I mean, there are lots of other things that are in the works, including photonics and DNA computing and all sorts of fancy things. But the significance of this is not just the speed of the computers, because, I mean, only geeks care about that. The real significance is that this firepower is opening up entirely new vistas for us in areas that were unimaginable before. I call these the GRIN technologies for genetics, robotics, information, and nanotech. I mean, for example, the sequencing of the human genome, figuring out, the entire DNA code for a human.
Which it seems like it took them forever to map, but all of a sudden they did it at a certain point. I think
Right. Computers,
when the computers got fast enough, that's when they got the job done.
That's right. And originally they thought that was going to take till 2015. They thought that is an impossible dream. It happened, 5 years ago. Why? Because, our technology, our information technologies allowed this whole new vista into genetics. Same thing is going on with something called nanotechnology. This is the science of the extremely small. It's creating material one atom at a time, one molecule at a time. And when you do that, you're creating stuff with unbelievable powers. For example, there is a form of carbon that's 60 times stronger than steel. It's the weight of plastic. It has the perfection of DNA. Has the electrical conductivity of diamond. I mean, this has the potential. There's already tons of this stuff that has been created in the United States. Nanotech is supposed to be a business by 2015 that's the size of today's GNP of Canada. I mean, it has amazing potential to do everything from get us into space cheaply to ending the energy crisis.
It hasn't taken off yet, though, has it?
In
terms of, because I've looked at some small public companies in the nanotech field. I mean, because I've told myself, you know what, I'm going to find the next McDonald's. I'm not going to make a mistake that I made when I was younger and not see some of these trends.
Yes.
And so when I have people on, experts in various fields, I say, you know what, one day that's going to be a great investment if these things are real. I think you're right, Joel. I think nanotechnology will be huge. But I've looked at some of the financial data from some of these companies. They're all losing money right now, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're talking about in investment terms, yeah, absolutely. Stay away. It's not right for this yet. This is like biotech 20 years ago.
Yet on the day one of them announces some major breakthrough for something, their stock's probably going to zoom, and it might be too late.
Right. Well, I've got some stock advice if you want, if you're looking for that.
Well, a little bit later on, we'll have you talk to our listeners about nanotechnology stocks because they're interested in that. As long as you disclose whether...
Think about the memory drugs in 3 years.
Well, that's true, too. All you got to do is disclose whether you own any of the shares or not. That's all I ask.
I own nothing. Okay. I'm just a reporter.
All right. Well, that's true. And a good one, I'm told.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about you before we get back into this. I'm curious how you got involved in all this.
Well, I've been a reporter and editor at the Washington Post for way too long now. And my area of interest is culture and values, as we said. You know, who we are, how we got that way, where we're headed, and what makes us tick. And I stand at different windows from time to time to look at what kind of light it reflects on who we are. My first book was called The Nine Nations of North America. That suggests that if you want to understand how the continent works, you should view it as if it were nine separate civilizations or economies that pay very little attention to the old-fashioned political boundaries of states or even countries. The second book was called Edge City, Life on the New Frontier, and that was how we were going through the biggest revolution in 150 years and how we build cities, that every urban area worldwide that is growing like Los Angeles with multiple urban cores. I mean, the John Wayne Airport area down in Orange County, for example, now has more office space and cloth napkin restaurants than Seattle does.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And now radical evolution is, again, trying to figure out what makes us tick by looking at us taking control of our own evolution for the first time. And that's a pretty dramatic change. That's the fifth or sixth biggest holy cat story in the last 10,000 years, depending on how you count the birth of Jesus Christ.
Well, when you went to school, did you get a degree in journalism, or was it engineering? What was it in?
Oh, no, I was really bad. I went to the University of Notre Dame, and it and I didn't get along very well. So
spent too much time on those Saturday football games, huh?
You know, one of the things that my problem with Notre Dame is I suspect I really would have liked football if I hadn't gone to that school.
Were you there when Rudy was there playing? Remember that?
I was there with Ara Parsegian and those people.
Oh, he was a giant, though, in his day. I'll tell you. It was a good school, though. Good university. I'm sure they taught you well.
They did. And I've never seen it snow in South Bend in July or August.
You never will, either.
Every other month I've seen it snow.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I mean, what was your background in?
Well, I come from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which is the first town in North America with a factory in the late 1700s, and the first town in North America with a polluted river next to the factory. So I was pretty eager to get away from that. And in a lot of ways, my life really started when I got to Washington and the Washington Post, and it gave me the opportunity. I've essentially been a foreign correspondent in my own country for the last 25 years. I've been traveling all over the country, talking to people, getting to know places, you know, talking to real people, getting away from policymakers. And I guess my job has essentially been to bring into the isolated, insulated world of Washington the news from the great out there, that, you know, that what reality is out there and it's coming to get you has been my message over the years.
Well, when you write in Radical Evolution that some of the things that they're working on for the future will either become our heaven or our hell, they really could go in either way, either direction.
Yeah.
That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, take a look at, I mean, someday in the very near future, your kid's going to come home from school in tears again. And the reason is that he just can't compete with the kids who are more athletic, smarter, better behaved, more beautiful, and more capable than he is as a human being. And the reason is that his parents have bought the enhancements that are increasingly coming on the market, and you haven't. So the question is, well, you know, what do you say to this kid? One possibility is you say, I don't care what other parents are doing to their kids' mind and memory and body. We love you just the way you are. Or you say, well, look, I guess we got to, you know, remortgage the house again for a third time to kind of keep up with this arms race of these enhancements that are increasingly available to humans. or you try to get the enhanced kids thrown out of your school. And if you do that, you're going to just increasingly widen the gap between the enhanced people and the naturals who could take advantage of these brand new technologies, but choose not to, like today's vegetarians.
And that could be very dangerous for the future.
Yep. And the thing is, I mean, this is not science fiction. I spent the better part of a year with the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA.
Oh, yeah.
This is the research and development arm of the Pentagon, and they are in the forefront of human enhancement at the Defense Sciences Office. So, for example, I mean, the stuff that they're doing really boggles the mind. They've already, for example, funded Belle, who's a monkey at Duke, and she is telekinetic. She can move objects long distance with her thoughts. I'm not making this up.
How does she do this?
I'm so glad you asked. Well, the way you make a the way you make a telekinetic monkey is the first thing you do is you get her hooked on computer games.
Okay.
Belle had this joystick and this screen, and she could control the cursor, and if she caused the cursor to hit a flashing light, she got a drop of juice. But within a week or so, it was pretty clear she's a smart monkey. She could almost care about this juice. She's really hooked on the computer game. And as soon as they did that, then they drilled a hole in her head, and they took a device that was smaller than a penny with hundreds of superfine wires coming out of it, and they put it into her motor cortex, the part of the brain that controls muscle movement.
Okay.
And these little wires lined up with individual neurons in the brain so that they could read these parts of the brain as they were firing in real time. Once they had that all set up, they patched her up and fired up the computer game. And as she played it, they watched her brain neurons firing through the computer, through the device. As soon as they figured out which part of the brain firing was associated with what part of her muscle movement, then they disconnected the joystick. Okay? So the only way she can play this game is with her thoughts.
Okay, and this is where the fun really started, I bet.
Right. And sure enough, not only could she control the cursor just with her thoughts, winning the game just by staring at it and thinking about it, but then to be cool about it, they took this signal and they piped it 600 miles north up to MIT, where it was piped into a robotic arm. And sure enough, the signals from her brain caused the robotic arm to dance like a ballerina in exactly the same way that her arm would have moved if she had been using her arm to play the game. So what she can, if she can control a robotic arm up at MIT from 600 miles away, what you basically got is a telekinetic monkey who can move objects with her thoughts.
With infant technology in that area.
Right. With real basic, this is extremely primitive, although last summer it was installed in the first human being. Last summer, a guy named Matthew Nagel up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, he's an unfortunate case. He got into a knife fight some years ago.
Oh, that's the paraplegic, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so anyway, so he's locked up from the neck down. His spinal cord has been severed. But he's had exactly the same kind of technology installed in his brain by a company called CyberKinetics. And so last summer, he became the first human to send an email with his thoughts.
And wait a minute. He actually sent an email by thinking about it?
Yep.
I mean, let's say you want to email me, george@coasttocoastam.com. Mm-hmm. He thinks of that address first?
You don't have this in your brain yet, George?
I'm not sure. Hey, let's take this. We'll take this break, Joel, and come back. I want you to tell us a little bit more about this. And then what happens if he has, like, weird thoughts? How does he maybe he changes what he wants to do. I'll be back in a moment. Technology, it's going faster than I thought. We'll be back. Hey, an upcoming issue of the After Dark newsletter is going to be on psychics and a dandy, so you can get that. And also the free CD called Perfect Possession, the interview Art did with Father Malachi Martin, a collector's item. That's given to you when you renew or subscribe to After Dark, and then you can get the issue on psychics, which will be forthcoming as well. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online, coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back with our guest, Joel Giroux, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Joel Giroux. Joel, let's talk a little bit about that individual, the paraplegic, who was tragically stabbed, I guess, in the spine.
And
tell me again about how they operated on him and what he's able to accomplish.
Well, I mean, the stuff that he's got wired up to is really pretty primitive. I mean, when I say that he sent the first email with his thoughts, all we're really talking about is that he can control a cursor on a screen with his thoughts, which means that he can, in effect, type out a message to you. It's not like if he had a dirty idea that it would suddenly be transmitted. But the thing is, I mean, the question that you have to ask yourself is, well, why is the military investing in technology like this? What's the object of the game? And there's two answers to that. The official answer is that an F-22 jet fighter is a very difficult aircraft to fly with a joystick. So the reason DARPA is doing this is because they're thinking, well, how much better it would be if you could have a what they call a mind-machine interface.
Mm-hmm.
How much better it would be if you could actually fly that plane with your thoughts directly and have everything that the plane is sensing, from its radar to its radios, and have that pipe directly into your brain, bypassing screens and keyboards. And that's why they're investing in this sort of, that's the official reason. Then there's the real reason, which is that the Defense Sciences Office, which has been promoting this, has been run until recently by a guy named Michael Goldblatt. And he's got a daughter named Gina Marie, who's a very accomplished young lady, student at the University of Arizona, and she has cerebral palsy. So supposedly, she's going to spend the rest of her life in a wheelchair. Well, her father is investing, you know, untold millions of taxpayers' dollars in this sort of technology because he recognizes that if you can control machines with your mind, there's no reason why those machines couldn't be in Gina Marie's legs. And if that were possible, then she could get up and walk and do so sometime in the next 10 or 15 years. That's why they're investing in technology like this.
I mean, he is doing this primarily for his love of his daughter?
Yeah, he's pretty upfront about it.
I've never heard that before. That is an amazing story. And government lets him do this?
It's more amazing because I was saying, you know, the first time he told me this story, we were having lunch at a Chinese restaurant near DARPA. And so I said, okay, I mean, you realize what this adds up to, that you're talking about fundamentally altering humans. I said, so to save your daughter, you're willing to fundamentally alter human nature? And there was this 8-beat pause, and he said, fundamentally altering human nature would be an unintended consequence.
He's obsessed with taking care of his daughter.
That's, you know, fundamentally altering human nature would be an unintended consequence. That's one of those quotes you don't have to bother writing down. You know, you're not going to forget.
Exactly. You know, one of the things, Joel, with the human mind, when you're talking about guiding a jet with your mind, I don't think the human mind is capable of staying on one thought. You know, here's an example. A great-looking car goes by. You think, boy, maybe I want to buy one like that. Maybe I don't. What did it cost? How much fuel does it take? I mean, all these things go through your head when you're doing it. If you were controlling, let's say, a missile with your brain thoughts or a jet in the direction of where you wanted to go, what happens when that brain doesn't focus? You know, you can't concentrate on going, fly straight, fly straight, fly straight. I mean, your mind plays all kinds of tricks. I mean,
sure.
The pilot may be thinking about what happens if someone shoots a missile at me. What's my girlfriend doing now that I'm away? I mean, anything could be going on through this guy's head. How would that affect flying that plane with your brain?
Well, two things. First of all, what you're describing is the conscious part of your brain, which, you know, the part where you're actually aware of what you're thinking.
Yes.
Which is only a very tiny portion of what's going on in that piece of meat between our ears. And there are already lots of humans who have got mind-machine interfaces. For example, there's something called a cochlear implant, which is a hearing aid, but it's really a tiny computer stuck in your ear, and it's wired directly into the auditory nerves so that, I mean, it completely bypasses the ear mechanism, so it allows profoundly deaf people to hear for the first time.
One of our network talk show hosts, Rush Limbaugh, has one of those, I believe. Yeah.
And the next step that's coming online this year, in fact, is the ocular implant, which is the same thing except it's for your eye. So you have, in effect, a computer in your eye socket that's directly wired into your brain that allows the blind to see. I mean, this is stuff that's on the market right now. This is not science fiction.
And will it get better and better and better?
Well, it'll certainly get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and smaller and smaller and smaller. That's part of the implications of the curve of exponential change. You know, what that's driving an awful lot of these technologies. You know, who hasn't had the experience of buying a whiz-bang computer for their kid for $2,000 one Christmas and then discovering the very next Christmas that the same kind of machine is available for like $1,300. Well, the curve of exponential change means that what you bought for $2,000 one Christmas, 10 Christmases later, will cost only $31.25, and you'll be able to get it for free with a subscription to Newsweek.
True. Or it'll also be better than what it was 10 years ago.
Right. You can either it'll be that much more powerful, or it'll be that much more cheap. I mean, already there are literally refrigerator magnets in people's kitchens that have more computing power than the entire North American Air Defense Command did back when Gordon Moore made his first prediction in 1965.
That's right. You know, here's a perfect example with that too, Joel, the VHS machine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, years ago, those things were bulky, big, expensive. I remember paying $800 for one a long, long time ago. Now look at them. I mean, they're giving them away. I mean, they're disposable practically. You get them for $45.
Right. Well, you know, we were just hanging around the newsroom the other day trying to remember how we put out a newspaper without the internet and without cell phones. We're old enough to know that it had to have been possible, but we're just darned if we can remember how we ever imagined trying to do it.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I remember being a news director at the NBC television station in St. Louis a long time ago. And at that time, before it was sold, it was owned by the owners of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Pulitzers. And a friend of mine worked for the newspaper, and he came in one day, and he said, "George, I've just been reassigned." And I said, "Well, Dick, what's your new job going to be?" And he said, "I'm in charge of computer technology for the newspaper." And this was in 1979. And I said, "Well, what's that entail?" And he said, "Well, I don't know yet, but they told me that one day this entire newspaper will be on the computer." And I had no idea what he was talking about. And that was in 1979. Now look at it.
Well, and the thing is that this is now what's going on. That's the direction that our bodies and our minds are headed into. I mean, the things that we have seen, you know, just in the last 10 and 20 years, we're increasingly going to be seeing this happen to our minds and our memories and our bodies. 3 years from now, for example, there are right now 5 United States companies that are in stage 2 clinical trials on memory pills. And if these experiments continue to work successfully, within 3 to 5 years, you should have these things on the market. And that, by the way, is a stock tip.
And this isn't ginkgo biloba stuff, is it?
Oh, no, this works. Yeah. No, this is the real deal. This is initially aimed at baby boomers banishing their senior moments, and I can hardly wait. You know, but memory is at the core of just about all sorts of learning. I mean, think of language acquisition alone. So the big question is, what happens if you can buy an additional 200 points on your kid's SAT scores? You know, how about the kids whose parents don't do that? How will you possibly compete? And that's just the beginning. That's 3 years out.
You may be creating geniuses with things like that.
No, I mean, you're talking about enhancing cognition and in the, you know, being able to increase the speed with which people process, you're talking about being able to more directly connect to human beings. I mean, you know, you look at the piercings that kids have today. Well, some of those piercings are going to be pretty smart in the not too distant future. It's easy right now there are troops in Iraq who've got computers on their chest that are universal translators. They say something and the computer translates it, and it works two ways. It's only got about 5,000 words, but that's still pretty amazing.
Does it talk to them, or do you have to read it out on a display?
No, it talks. It outputs an audio, and it understands other people, you know, who talk into it and translates it into audio for you. It's audio in two directions.
I think they use some of that, like at the United Nations, or are they individuals screaming in everybody's ears?
The UN, they're way behind the time.
Ah, okay.
Right now, for example, 10% of all emergency room doctors dictate their notes directly into a computer that automatically turns it into print. I mean, this is the super dictation. It recognizes what you're saying and automatically turns it into print. By 2010, you're likely to see the majority of all documents being created by voice, not by typing. This technology already exists. We're just waiting for the price to come down, which it will because of the curve of change. You know, one of the calls that I got when Radical Evolution came out, I mean, you can never tell which companies are going to react to this, but this one really kind of amazed me. One of the first companies that called was an automobile company. I thought, an automobile company that's interested in human evolution and engineered evolution? Well, anyway, they're totally convinced that by their 2010 model year, there'll be a computer on board all of their cars that'll understand your speech and will talk back to you, in readily understood speech. And it'll say things like, I can tell from what direction we're going in and where we're headed and what time it is that there's no way we're going to be able to pick up your daughter at her school.
Oh, my God.
So would you like me to call her and tell her that we'll be 17 minutes late? This is an increasing bond between our helpful little helpmates. You know, and coming back to the translation devices, it's not going to be long before those translation devices are the size of jewelry.
And it'll probably be connected to police department traffic centers. It'll probably be able to say, of course, you do know, Joel, there's an accident 15 miles away. We better look for an alternative way to get there.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the whole point of this network effect, is that there are already now more computers on board a new car, more processors than there are light bulbs. And the thing is that as we start to connect these things up and start pooling this intelligence, you know, we're talking about fundamentally changing our relationship to our machines and, you know, as we head on down the road, fundamentally changing our cognition and our memory and what it means to be human.
As you look, Joel, with your experience as a reporter into this future, I know you said earlier you didn't make predictions into the book. Can you make some for us now? What's out there?
Well, I can tell you what's in the lab. I can report on that.
Okay, and then add a year to it with the whatever it is.
Well, I mean, for example, one of the things that DARPA is very interested in, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is creating soldiers who don't have to sleep for as much as a week. Now, you can go without sleep for a long time, but it really messes up your mind, as you know. I mean, your cognition really goes to heck.
Sure. The longer it goes, the more whacked out you get.
Well, they're real interest. Whales and dolphins, for example, they never sleep. They can't sleep. They're mammals. If they slept, they drown. Right? So what they've done is they've evolved an ability to knock off half a brain at a time so that half a brain is resting while the other half is functioning. And they're very interested, DARPA is very interested in figuring out how we might mimic that. And as a side effect, if you could control what portions of your brain were functioning, that holds out great promise for Alzheimer's. But in the meantime, think of what a soldier who didn't have to sleep, I mean, think of the rings that you could run around the competition. And think of what that that kind of technology will do for things for people like UPS and Federal Express. Think what it'll do to medical students who are, you know, going through their residency.
What about truck drivers who don't get tired?
Yeah, and aircraft pilots. And the question is, you know, if you're starting to beginning, if you're seeing increasingly augmented people coming online with abilities like this, what do you do? How do you compete about against this, or do you just have to choose to become enhanced yourself? Another example that they're working on, for example, is a soldier who doesn't have to eat for a week.
He doesn't have to eat for a week?
Right. And this is a big problem for the military. The a special forces trooper can easily burn 12,000 calories in a day, and if he doesn't have to, and if he doesn't sleep, it's going to be even more calories than that. And you just can't eat that much in a day. I mean, that's like three meals ready to eat and 46 power bars.
Yeah, when you're on the way out there in the desert or wherever you may be, you're right.
I mean, you can't even carry that kind of. So they're saying, well, now wait a minute. Rather than getting your energy from protein and carbohydrates that you're eating, why don't you just, you know, go right to the energy that you're walking around carrying in your fat cells right now and burn that? And I'm, you know, and I'm writing this all down and I'm listening to them, and it's finally dawning on me that they're talking about burning your fat on command.
Sounds like a weight loss program.
And I raised my hand. Yeah, I raised my hand. I said, me, give some to me. You know? and they kind of smile this little smile, and they say, dieting is a $40 billion a year industry in this country. The civilian implications of this technology has not eluded us.
If it's safe, it could be huge.
Oh, yeah. Now, will this all work? How do I know? But the point is that, you know, if you're looking at across in labs and hospitals and universities across the world, you're seeing this complete rush towards all of these enhancements and what it means to be human. And, you know, the odds are that some of this is going to start to work soon, if not here, then in China or Korea or India or Japan or Europe. And this is all happening at an increasing pace, which is why I'm arguing that we're looking at fundamentally changing what it means to be human, not in some distant future, but on our watch in the next 10 or 20 years.
What about the moral question, though, Joel, of should we alter humans this way?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I wish we'd been asking questions like this when we were sold nuclear power, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
True.
But this goes to the issue of the three scenarios that, you know, are that people that right now, the reason I've been typing as fast as I can on radical evolution is that these conversations right now are largely being held in the halls of the technological elite, the digerati, who are creating this stuff. And I think it's more than time for us to start bringing this out to ordinary people to realize what it is they're up against, because I think by pooling our wisdom collectively, that's the way we're going to get into the future successfully.
Joel, when we come back, I want to ask you about the cover of your book, Radical Evolution, Adam and Eve and the Serpent. This is a very strange cover for this kind of book. Back in a moment.